Welcome to Inside Ivy Hoops. Mike Tony of Ivy Hoops Online, joining you in a very surreal atmosphere. The sports world has been shut down. The one thing the coronavirus can't take away, though, is the world of podcasting. So joining me now, IHO writer extraordinaire, Rob Brown, to help me make sense of just truly extraordinary 48 hours. Rob, how are you feeling?
I'm okay in the big picture. A little emotionally wrung out in the immediate picture. A week or so ago, I was expecting to be doing this podcast with you tonight while I was in Boston, just after the first round of press conferences for the women's tournament, but obviously life had other things in store for all of us. So I'm here in body and mostly in mind, and ready to talk some hoops with you.
Yeah, there's always something to be grateful for, and it's great to be talking with you and getting the word out to our listeners out there. In spite of very disappointing week, really a jarring one. It was only 48 hours ago, as we tape this, a little more, roughly 48 hours, that the Ivy League announced an extraordinary move at the time. That it was canceling the men's and women's conference tournaments. I reached out to you, Rob, to set up our recording on this. At that time, the move was being widely panned on Twitter by current and former players, coaches, saying that, the league had really lurched out into left field, making an unnecessary move in shutting down the tournament as opposed to simply restricting spectator attendance. Today it's an altogether different tune on Twitter and on the web. There's a recognition, certainly a growing one, in light of the sports world at large shutting down NBA, NHL, Major League Soccer, all suspended, NCAA tournament shut down, all winter and spring NCAA championships canceled due to the ongoing public health threat that is the coronavirus COVID-19. Officially a pandemic at this point. The conversation changed very quickly today and late yesterday. Really, it's extraordinary the pace with which the situation is changing. But Rob, you captured well in a post about the NBA shutting its season down. The fact that this is something that the Ivy League was ahead of the curve on. Many now saying that the league has in fact been vindicated in going out. Stepping out ahead of this to try to keep people safe and really practice what health officials are preaching right now with regard to social distancing. What are your thoughts, generally speaking, Rob, on the Ivy League's move?
I think when looking at it now, Thursday, courageous move on a lot of levels. And at the moment that they made the announcement on Tuesday, was it Tuesday?
It was. It seems, yes.
You know, I think I had sent you a message really quickly that I was in support of that decision. I thought it was the right decision. The interesting part is, if I take a step back, you know, going through a little bit of a timeline aspect, you know, I think I included this in one of the articles, that I started personally reaching out to them 2 weeks ago with this idea of what's going on with the coronavirus. Are you guys planning? If you have contingencies in place, what's going on? And I kept getting very, either no comments or very simple, of course, yes, we're working with local, state, and federal authorities. So I know that I'm sure, I don't know that for a fact, but I'm sure they were, you know, over the couple week period, they had been talking to everybody. But one of the big problems, I think, that certainly manifested itself on Tuesday was the lack of transparency, the lack of communication. You know, as things started getting worse a week ago, 6 days ago, 5 days ago, I was still getting no comments and we haven't made a decision yet. You know, you had people coming from all around the country, maybe even internationally. You certainly had regional travel. You had hotel reservations. People needed to know what was going on, both for the actual tournament, but also in the big picture. You know, transparency equals trust. And I think one of the things that the Ivy League office, as much as they're going to get tremendous positives for this, for their ultimate decision, there's a lot of negatives with how they handled this. They were not very open to their fans, to the athletes, to the coaches. When the announcement finally came down on Tuesday, the athletes kind of felt like they were sucker punched. The coaches also. I think Mike McLaughlin had said that you know, the coaches' input amounted for very little. They were all in shock that this was happening. Robin Harris gave some interviews to Harvard Crimson, to the New York Times, but not much was really said, and I think that really is what caused the anger. And I think if they had been more open and honest with their, well, I guess they would term their stakeholders, I think things would have been a little better on Tuesday. But they went a different route, and they caught a lot of grief. And at the moment, you know, a lot of it was justifiable, but of course, entering into Wednesday, people started to a little bit of the logic of what was going on as things were happening nationally. And then once you know, the Utah Jazz game happened on Wednesday night with Rudy Gobert, you know, I think that at that moment, of course, you know, everything, just like all the anger and frustration, kind of melted away towards the league officials, and they were, you know, rightly praised for their decision. So I guess the end justifies the means away. But I do hope going forward that they, you know, realize that, you know, to keep everybody in the loop a little bit more. And when you spend all of your time talking about tournaments and rearranging the back-to-back schedules, and you talk about how we do this for the athletes and we do this for the students, and then you don't listen to the students when they have complaints and want to play a game, you know, don't be surprised that you're going to get called hypocrites and you're going to get a lot of backlash. So I hope when they reevaluate how they how this went down, that they at least learn those lessons for the future.
Yeah, we talk a lot about and we try to, you know, at IHO, we try to keep the focus on what's important in the grand scheme of things, which is not really the game itself. It's more of, from an Ivy League basketball perspective, the, you know, the fellowship and the scholarship that goes into making the endeavor what it is. And to that end, you know, seeing the acceptance of the decision and the recognition of you know, the gravity of the situation today has been good to see. You know, the Ivy League, you know, how it got there is another matter, as you alluded to, as you've just spelled out. But, you know, getting there and, you know, getting the stakeholders, as it were, pretty much on board today, you know, I do think that's noteworthy and of value. Eric Monroe, Yale senior, tweeted out 3 hours ago thanking all of the Ivy League school presidents and others involved that decided to call off the tournament before any other sporting event in the mainstream really was called off. And sticking with their decision in spite of the backlash. You know, he talked about how, you know, playing in the big dance, which Yale had earned the right to do by virtue of the Ivy League regular season championship, with the tournament, conference tournament being canceled, you know, that was his lifelong goal. As I'm sure, you know, a lot of seniors wanted to get into the conference tournament and extend their careers. And, you know, it, you strive for something, and your college education is shaped by it. You know, you choose your college in some of these cases because of the basketball program, in many of the cases, because of the basketball program, you kind of mold your life around working toward being great at a certain thing, and the capstone is torn away from you with little or no warning. That's a very, very tough pill to swallow. And it's understandable that there was a petition started by Ivy League's basketball student athletes. It's gotten more than 12,000 signatures at this point, asking to reinstate the tournament that was abruptly canceled. Many familiar names among the signatures. Leah Parker, Madison Hardy, Ellen Margaret Andrews, you know, a lot of, an awful lot of signatures in a short amount of time. But,
you know, it's funny, Mike, we had talked a lot over the course of this season about the attendance issues. And, and I took a lot of pleasure in seeing the number of signatures go on that petition. One, because it was great to see the students channel their frustration into a proactive stance and try and challenge the leadership of the conference. I thought that was a really constructive thing to do. But it was also great to see the amount of passion that came out with 12,000 fans in such a short period of time. You know, I think those of us that follow the league know how great a product it is and how great the athletes are. And it was just super to see that there is an audience out there and there are people who support them. Even if they don't come out to every game, they certainly are there supporting them, and, you know, especially when the chips are down.
Yeah, that is a good point. I mean, I think, you know, at this, some of those signatures, you know, maybe they wouldn't sign it at this point. Maybe some of them would, but you know, the support is encouraging. You're right, absolutely. But you know, so too is the support going the other way toward the league for trying to take a very proactive measure in you know, something, you know, the likes of which we really haven't seen, experienced as a society, in this country for a long time.
Yeah, like when I was mentioning about Tuesday when the announcement came out, I think even if all this stuff hadn't played out over the last 48 hours the way it did, I still think it was the right decision. You know, you have a situation where it's not just the individual. So if an individual wants to take his or her own chance and risk getting sick and say, you know, I'm going to be able to tolerate it, that's fine. But this is the kind of situation that you take it with you and you bring it back to your home, and then it becomes your family and your neighbors and your coworkers, and your decision is not just you. It becomes a whole community, a much larger concentric circle that's expanding. And I think that the league did a good job listening to the public health officials and realizing, you know, just something very small can spiral out of control very quickly.
Yeah, and the announcement did come the same day as Harvard announced that the university would move all courses to remote instruction after spring break. So, you know, there was already, you know, there it was in tandem with momentum on campus toward taking swift action to try to combat the coronavirus outbreak. So, you know, it's not as if this decision was made in a vacuum. You know, the university was on, you know, on board with it, certainly. Very simpatico in the announcements coming that day. It was interesting, the gamut of responses Tuesday. You know, Tommy Amaker coming out with a supportive statement, as you might expect, given that you know, he's the coach of the host university. Penn really stood out to me as being the most vocal against the move. Steve Donahue and Mike McLaughlin really on Tuesday saying, well, you know, look at these other student athletes of other sports or continuing competition. Of course, all of that has, you know, come to a jarring stop now. But you know, it's all understandable. You know, I don't really fault anyone for having any reaction to this within the realm of responses that we've seen. You know, there's not a lot of precedent to lean on scrambling for context to try to relate to in evaluating a decision of that magnitude. But yeah, I think to put it succinctly, it was the right decision, a tough one, a disorienting one, but you know, the right one nevertheless. So we'll see what you know, how this plays out going forward. But you know, social distancing is a powerful thing. You know,
never heard that term before before last week. At least I don't believe I have.
Yeah, it's
now I'm a pseudo expert in it, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are becoming familiar with that phrase and what it means, and measuring how far they're standing away from people when they're out in public now, making sure they're 3 feet away. So you know, you can't lose your head either. I mean, life does go on. Just a matter of discretion.
You know, before everything happened yesterday, when it was just the Ivy League announcement out there and solo, and the petition was out there, I just had this vision in my head that all the players would get nowhere with the league, and they would all somehow find a way to a gym in the New York area. They would just have their own tournaments. It's like Rocky and Apollo having that private fight at the end of Rocky III. Having their own private Ivy League tournament for a couple days.
Just a pickup, yeah. Yeah, that Absolutely. Would be, yeah, you could do their own 3-on-3, maybe.
Yeah,
but no, you're right. I mean, it's not like deciding, well, it's okay for me to play football. You know, you can't, you can't bring a concussion home and right. pass it along to somebody. It is what it is, and let's hope it's a one-time thing.
There is now, but let's hope it's a one-time thing.
Yes. So the other news, and really it pales in comparisons. It's really been released in the shadow of the sports world as we know it, coming to a screeching halt. But the Ivy League did announce its all league selections this year. On the men's side, some ties, some co awardees, and six All Ivy first teamers. Not the first time that's happened by any stretch. A.J. Broder and Paul Atkinson sharing Ivy League Player of the Year, the first such honor for each, and obviously the last for Broder, who came into the award cycle, as it were, with most momentum possible after a night for the ages. In what turned out to be his final collegiate game, triple-double, becoming the school's all-time leading scorer and shot blocker in the same game, passing Ernie Beck, 1953 grad, who was on hand to congratulate Broder in a very classy move. That was the longest-standing Division I scoring record for any program, really just an astounding 67-year run by Ernie Beck atop the scoring record book for Penn. Paul Atkinson, what can you say about him? A very efficient scorer, and really just... It's fun to watch. It was fun to watch him, this year get better at just contorting his body to get high percentage shots deep in the paint, pretty much no matter what defense was draped over him at times. He just creates easy shots better than probably anybody in the league. James Jones, Coach of the Year. Jordan Dingle of Penn. Getting the nod as Rookie of the Year. Jalen Gabadon of Yale and Jalen Ganey of Brown, co-defensive players of the year. No surprise that Jones got Coach of the Year. Other All-Ivy first-teamers, Ezra Swain of Yale, Noah Kirkwood of Harvard, Richmond Raguzzo of Princeton, Jordan Bruner of Yale. A lot of big men in the first team and the second team. Chris Knight and Chris Lewis, both in there for Dartmouth and Harvard, respectively. And then Jalen Llewellyn of Princeton, Tamanin Cho of Brown, Mike Smith of Columbia, second team. Evan Goodman of Penn, Terrence McBride of Cornell. Does that sound about right to you, Rob? Were you surprised at any of the placings? Any snubs or any thoughts on the selections from the league?
I'm obviously the Coach of the Year starting there. That seems just a given. In the world of the Ivy League, Texas and James Jones coming in the top four of the Ivy League. So losing four starters and having the season they had, a top 50 team, that was a remarkable job. I just love the way he molds his team every year, a center, a forward, a wing, a shooting guard, a point guard. It's just nice old-time basketball, and they play so smart. And he always finds guys that just, they don't play a lot the first year or two, time, like even someone like Eric Monroe, who's not on this list, but man, what a valuable player. I mean, he just was such a fantastic point guard. So when he gets his 1 year or 2 years to shine, they're ready. It's always great. Certainly well-deserved. Co-players of the year, can't argue with that. A.J. Broder, I mean, we talked about him the first show of the season when we were going through the team of the decade. Just an all-time great, a great player, a great teammate, and a great representative of the program. Always willing to be interviewed, stand up for the team, stand up for himself, whether it's a win or a loss. That last game was phenomenal, the first triple-double in program history. And you're right, Ernie Beck was a phenomenal player and 88 years old, and he looked fantastic and he sounded great when they interviewed him. His records and points and rebounds, I mean, especially with points, 3 years and no 3-point line, just like Bill Bradley, just a phenomenal job that those older players, what they accomplished. Broder did it all. Paul Atkinson, you're right, just gets better and better every year. He was, even when he came off the bench as a freshman, his accuracy was outstanding, and it's just so talented, so good. Next year is going to be an interesting year. It's not going to be the same Yale team, but there'll be somebody new to help him out in the front court. So I'm not worried about that, but well-deserved. Rookie of the Year, Jordan Dingle. I think that was the right choice. Certainly one of the most electric players in the league. Had a little bit of a lull during the middle of the season, but I think when Steve Donahue moved him to the bench, it actually kind of improved things. He started hitting a lot of double-digit efforts at the end of the year, especially as Penn made that push for the number four spot. Chris Ledlam, super talented player for Harvard, especially with that 360 dunk against Yale on the last night of the regular season. Certainly well-deserved if he had gotten it. Max Martz, another, threat from the outside for Penn, another great rookie, but Dingle certainly was the strongest of those three. First team, Azar Swain, his first day in the blue and white scrimmage, James Jones was interviewed and he said he's an assassin from the 3-point line. And you didn't see it so much the first year and the second year, but boy, was that. Not a problem for that guy. Noah Kirkwood. The interesting thing with Noah Kirkwood is, right, one of the most unsung players. He's so talented, but with Tommy Amaker's system, there's always so many guys rotating, and every night's a different person, and then you have to deal with all the injuries. But I think Noah Kirkwood was the rock of that team. He was the most consistent player. His numbers might have been as gaudy as some others in the league, but certainly, there are very few as talented. Richmond Arirguzo, I thought he was more of a second team. I think his numbers were just a little bit less strong than he was last year. But you know what? He always outplays AJ Broder. So, that enough is worthwhile for first team All Ivy. And Jordan Broder blocks, scores. And I think what's fascinating is, the loss at Penn earlier in the season was when he had just come back from an injury, and it was the second night of a back-to-back. So even if he wasn't the top scorer on the team, top rebounder, although he may have been top rebounder, but he was kind of the guy that made that team go that extra step. So I see he's the last player on the first team. I'm guessing he had the lowest number of votes, but I kind of had thought he was the third best player right under the Broder and second team, a lot of talented people. I guess I'm surprised with Mike Smith. It looks like he almost dropped off that list. An outstanding scorer, an elite scorer. But I guess when your team is 1-13, it's I guess that's gonna be tough to kind of have a higher spot on these lists. Jalen Llewellyn certainly lived up to the hype when he came in as a freshman. Fantastic season. Chris Knight. I mean, my gosh, there's a guy who certainly could have made a play for the first team. He almost got Dartmouth into the playoff. A phenomenal athlete. Chris Lewis was a rock as usual. Temenang Cho, again, like Bruner, does everything well. I guess if there's one surprise, in answer to your original question, I guess I'm surprised Brandon Anderson. He's the guy I really was surprised didn't make this list. One of the top scorers in the league. As much as Cho's an outstanding player for Brown, I kind of thought Brandon Anderson was the heart and soul of that team. I was kind of disappointed not to see him, you know, get at least an honorable mention, if not a second team, or even, you know, I think an argument could have been made for him to be on the first team. And Terrence McBride did a great job at Cornell, really poured it on the second half of the year, especially when Jimmy Boeheim was injured. I guess the last person there, Devin Goodman, an outstanding player, well-deserved for honorable mention. He, if nothing else, you know, he's a great scorer, super fast, but his defense on Mike Smith at the Penn-Columbia game, an excellent job, another great all-around guard, and certainly a credit to the Penn program. So many talented players, it's hard to fit them into a list. I guess that's why they're all those ties.
The thing that really was, I found glaring was, as you noted, the omission entirely of Brandon Anderson, not even on the honorable mention list. I don't, it's hard to figure because he seemed to be someone who impacted the game at both ends. A very prolific pickpocketer on a team that, you know, didn't really seem to have really any weak links defensively. It was a strong defensive team. In fact, that's really the only way that Brown had a shot to get into the Ivy League tournament to begin with. The tournament that didn't happen, of course, but because Brown just didn't have much offensive potency at all in league play. What they did have, though, largely offensively, they had because of Anderson, getting to the foul line. Certainly he hit a high watermark with a 31-point performance at the Palestra in arguably one of the highlights of the season, certainly one of the highlights of the season for Brown. That win over Penn. Not seeing his name at all doesn't really seem right, frankly. And Jimmy Boeheim as well. Not making even the honorable mention list. He did miss four games due to injury during Ivy play, but I didn't think it was really enough to take away from his body of work for the season. And in fact, he finished very strong, playing only at about 50%, in Cornell's season finale win at Princeton, with a big shot down the stretch, 14 points in just 20 minutes. Strong rebounder, good passer, obviously a good scorer and somebody who Cornell really relied on heavily offensively during league play, very high usage rate.
American, correct?
What's that?
An academic All-American on top of that.
Yes, absolutely. So that's another, that's really sincerely another reason to consider him. I think that is a huge plus in his favor. And Mike Smith too, ostensibly being, 10th, 11th, because there were six, first teamers. I get the fact that they were 1-13. That argument works both ways, though. I mean, he didn't have a lot of help. When you're on a good team, and we see this every year, the players that are on the best teams, even if they're, in a bit more of a complementary role in some aspects, you know, they do get placed higher than players who are, you know, the heroes and heroines of their teams that are, you know, in the bottom half of the league. And that's clearly the case when you look at the second team and you see Chris Knight of Dartmouth, Tamanang Cho of Brown, Mike Smith of Columbia, you know, Terrence McBride of Cornell in the honorable mention, Jimmy Boeheim not on the list, Brandon Anderson not on the list. So, you know, you see that, and I feel like that's underrating Mike Smith and what he meant to the team and what he was asked to do night in and night out as the focal point, as a strong defender, you know, somebody who, you know, one of the best Steelers in the league. I think it's not hard to make the case that he should have been a first teamer, as opposed to somebody on the fringe of the second team. Defensive player of the year, it seems to be more than others one where you can just pick at least three or four every year, and they all would make just as much sense, be just as worthy. Justin Bassey certainly has long been the glue guy for Harvard. And I will say, while we're talking about, while I'm talking about Harvard, you know, I thought the coaching job that Tommy Amaker did during league play was underrated, especially at the tail end with Christian Zizang injured, Bryce Aiken already out. You know, obviously Seth Towns was never in the picture. So, you know, it was still a talented team, but, you know, the fact that Harvard was able to, you know, notch as many wins as it did during league play, you know, getting the 10 league wins, I thought was impressive. I still would give James Jones the coach of the year, but I thought Tommy Amaker did a fine job.
Absolutely.
You know, sweeping Yale is hard, and yet Harvard does it every year at this point. You know, minus the Ivy League tournament, that is. Jalen Gabadon, I mean, his steals down the stretch against Penn certainly come to mind, but he was, you know, he was that good all season, really stepping up in the absence of Trey Fills, you know, who was a defensive stalwart for years there in the Yale backcourt. Just a lot of good players, you know, a lot of worthy players. And on the women's side, there's, I don't know what you can say, player of the year, I don't think there's ever been more of a slam dunk choice. Bella Allery, in a snoozer, takes it yet again. Three-time Ivy player of the year, certainly one of the greatest players in Ivy League basketball history. What can you say? Coach of the year, obviously Carla Berube. Berube took over a team that was expected to win, but not expected to have the best defense in the country. You know, that was new. That was largely with the same personnel. You know, this became a team that just totally wore teams down, shut them down, stymied them completely in second halves of games. Rookie of the year, Kayla Padilla. That was a very competitive race, I thought, this year, especially on the women's side. Abby Hsu could make a great case. Really, so could Lola Mullaney, and even Shannon Mulroy of Cornell had some great moments, but It takes the award from the Ivy League. Leah Parker, also a Penn Defensive Player of the Year. Some dominant performances, protecting the rim for Parker yet again. Mallory, Carly Littlefield, Roxy Berryman, Parker, and Padilla make up the first team All-Ivy. Second team All-Ivy, Camilla Emsbo, Abby Hsu, Sienna Durr, also of Columbia, of course, Justine Gaziano-Brown in her senior campaign. Also, senior Jeannie Baim of Harvard making the second team. And then rounding out the list is honorable mentions Lola Mullaney, Samantha Widman of Cornell, Julia Cunningham of Princeton, and Laura Bagwell-Kanalinich of Cornell. A lot of talent there. So as I said, a lot of first-year firepower with Pia, Hsu, and Mullaney making the list. But for Princeton, two on the first team, Julia Cunningham is the honorable mention there. Any thoughts on that list of selections, Rob?
Bella Allery's just an all-time great potential first-round WNBA selection in a few months. I think we also knew that Carla Berube was a very good coach. I don't think we realized how good her defense was. Just the way she taught the defense to that team is incredible. As difficult as it was to see that Yale couldn't play on the men's side, I think it's an even harder acceptance that the Princeton women won't get a chance to play in the tournament because they had moved up to 17th in the country by the end of the season. The only blemish on their record was a 3-point overtime loss at Iowa. And Carly Littlefield was just getting back from an injury. So that team was realistically could have been undefeated again. It would have been really something to see if they could have made it into the second weekend of the NCAA tournament. We'll never know, but that was just some team. And those two are just fantastic. Littlefield is just, a tremendous competitor, super engine. You give her the ball and she just like runs with it. She doesn't stop for 40 minutes or 38 and a half minutes. It's incredible. And Allery does everything. And I think what was really great this year was she actually expanded her game. She went back and shot more from the three-point line, which she'll need in the pros. It was great to see her game. I was worried that with a new coach, something would happen, but it got even better. I certainly, Defensive Player of the Year, Olivia Parker, one of the nation's premier shot blockers. I certainly make an argument every year for Bella Allery because she's almost as good a shot blocker and maybe a better rebounder. But Olaya Parker is just ferocious. And when you see, if nothing else, that last weekend at Cornell and Columbia, she just took charge of both of those games and set the tone really early on the defensive end. You could just see like both of those teams, she hit them hard really quickly, and they both teams just like took a step back, and you just knew the game was over very quickly. Rookie of the Year, Kayla Padilla, phenomenal scorer. I mean, it's just incredible what she can accomplish. She can hit from the outside, she can drive the lane. She doesn't look like she can get in there, but really somehow she finds her spots. Real close to the basket. Watch. She's a real artist. But I think you're right. I mean, it was a tremendous year. A lot of rookies. Abby Hsu, really, really great for Columbia. Really took charge as that team made its run late in the season. I think that is a 6-game winning streak towards the latter part of the year. And she was really the main reason for that. Lola Mullaney, really tough. She had to step in after Katie Benzin decided to take the year off and then graduate transfer at Texas. So a lot was put on her shoulders, and she hit 20 points really quickly in the first game of the season and really never let up. Just a great outside shooter. Harvard's got a great foundation with her. in the backcourt, and then, you know, they'll get Jaden Bush back in the front court, Rachel Levy. So, you know, this wasn't the best year for Brown. I think they had a good run in the middle, but I think it was a year marked with inconsistency and trying to figure out things with Benson and Bush off the team for the year. So a tough year, but I have all the confidence that they'll be back for, Kathy Delaney Smith. It'll be her 39th or 40th year at Harvard next year, amazingly. But you were right, Shannon Mulroy at Cornell certainly had moments where, you know, she showed like she can light it up for 20, 30 points as well. She can really hit from the outside. So there's one more first year I know I'm forgetting, but Ellie Mitchell at Princeton, not on this list. But my gosh, I mean, next year and Princeton, you know, may not be the exact same team, but, you know, they're going to be just fine. She's a phenomenal player. Going back to the first team, Roxy Barriman, you know, just one of the best. I mean, she's just gotten better each year. It's a shame she's not going to be back next year, but it's just such a pleasure to watch her play week in and week out. Padilla, of course, made the team. Leia Parker was a little bit of a surprise, I would say, for me. I thought Camilla Emsbo had a much better year, her second year, than her first, playing in the forward spot for Yale. And I thought Parker had moments of greatness, but I think she had a little bit of a step back this year. I don't know if there was an injury. I don't know if it was Mike McLaughlin reconfiguring the team to take advantage of Padilla's scoring abilities, but somehow Parker didn't have the consistency. She had some highlight reel games, especially in the latter part of the Ivy League season, but I thought Emsbo had a more consistent year, but that's splitting hairs, of course. We talked about Abby Sue, Sienna Durr, you know, maybe not as strong a season as last year, but I think part of that is because Abby Sue showed up and she had to kind of take a step back and work as in more of a partnership role. And I think, you know, we saw that last year with Samantha Whitman at Cornell. She had gone from you know, a year of being the main focal point of the Cornell team and had a balance with Bagwell Katelinich. So I think it was the same with Sienna Durr. But her importance was just so obvious after she got injured. I think it was the Dartmouth game. There was a game where she got injured late in the season. And you could see, like, again, when they played at they had Princeton and Penn show up at Levian, Columbia wasn't the same team. You know, they really needed her energy, her you know, just complete commitment on the offensive side down low. But I think this year, you know, she had a better defensive year, which was really nice to see. Jeannie Baim, you know, fantastic player, really underrated, a double-double machine for Harvard, especially as we said earlier, you know, with Jaden Bush not playing this year. There were a lot of games through like the first half or two-thirds of the season where she was the only front-court player down there for Harvard. You know, Rachel Levy would come and spell her at times, but more or less it was Dame down there by herself, and she really, really did a fantastic job. And I'm kind of saving Justine Gaziano last year on the second team, even though she wasn't the last on that list. An elite scorer, I think she deserves a lot of credit. You know, that Brown team, there was not much hope for them going into this season. And I could have easily envisioned a situation where she stepped away for a year and saved that last year of eligibility and then a grad transfer like Katie Benson. I'm sure there were a lot of strong programs in the country that could have used her help, but, you know, she was committed to the program, committed to the team. You know, I think she deserves a tremendous amount of credit for that. Fantastic season on the women's side, just like the men's.
Yeah, I mean, there's always more talent than there are slots for, it seems. You know, I thought Janaya Clemens could have, you know, easily gotten, you know, at least an honorable mention from Columbia. You know, what she was able to contribute, you know, both offensively and as a pickpocketer. You know, very good passer. Really, kind of someone who does you know, a little bit of everything as a stat sheet stuffer for, you know, a resurgent Columbia team this season as a senior, you know, really the program turning around from where she found it, you know, definitely leaving it better than she found it for sure. And then, you know, nobody from Dartmouth.
Annie McKenna had a very good year.
Yes, I was just going to say, you know, Annie McKenna, somebody that stands out for, you know, being a sound ball distributor with a good assist to turnover ratio. You know, also, you know, a good scorer in her own right as well.
Ellen Margaret Andrews at Yale, who also, you know, bounced back from a major injury early last season and really took charge over the, especially in the first half of the season.
Yeah, yeah, that's another, I mean, you know, she easily could have been an honoree on the list. You know, she was a difference, I think, you know, Yale kind of collapsing down the stretch last year. You know, a stronger team certainly this year, but, you know, her scoring was definitely key throughout the season for Yale. You know, a pure scorer and also somebody who could really hit the boards hard at times for Yale. So
she had the go ahead three to beat Harvard on the last night of the season.
Yeah, it's a good way to finish the season, even if that was not not thought to be the finish at the time. But hey, what you know, treat every game like it's your last. But
I think we also need, you know, I probably forgot to mention also, like, for the Coach of the Year discussion, if, I mean, Berube certainly deserved that unanimous award, but in any other year, Megan Griffith of Columbia would have taken that award, and deservedly so.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, what a season Columbia had. You know, when you look at their history, you know, you see, you know, you kind of get how tough it was, how tough the job is there. You know, not a ton of precedents for smashing success at Columbia. So, you know, this season really was a remarkable run. Nothing flukish about it. You know, Columbia got it done down the stretch on the road in some big games to get to where it did. An outstanding season for Columbia. And, you know, apart from Clemens, you know, you've got a lot of talent that's coming back. Anything else about this season stand out to you, Rob, as noteworthy? Or you know, it's hard to kind of put a bow on things at this point, given the you know, the jarring stop that we've come to. But anything else noteworthy about this season come to mind? The big thing at this point is as you said, to me, is, you know, the opportunity lost for the Princeton women to make a special run, and how close they came to an undefeated season. Anything else come to mind for you, Rob?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing I notice on top of the Princeton women, obviously, is you know, the Harvard men. This was the league's most elite recruiting class, the senior class, number 10 in the nation when they arrived. Aiken and Baker and Towns and Welsh and Bassey and Juzang. I mean, you know, just stars in the league. And they will, no NCAA appearances. It's just shocking. Two titles, two co-championships. But, you know, injuries really took its toll. And obviously fate or know, added the third knock. You know, here they were, had the tournament on their court, number two seed. They swept Yale. This, even with all the injuries, this looked like the moment. And so I think history will show that that might have been the bigger disappointment. That's going to be a hard one for Harvard fans to kind of wrap their head around, that this outstanding group, one of the all-time greatest classes in school history, and no NCAA appearances. It's mind-boggling. That's a biggie for me.
Yeah, oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, you know, if you're Harvard, you get the number one seed in 2019, and you have to play Penn at the Palestra, and you lose in the title game. 2019, you get the number one seed, you have to play at Yale, and you lose in the tournament final, I should say. Again, then 2020, you get to be the number two seed at home this time, and then the tournament gets canceled, and your season is over, and the senior class is done. The opportunity lost there from a wins and loss, from a NCAA tournament appearance perspective, it's just what you said. It's mind-boggling. It's really hard to say that they underachieved, because they were that's not true. It's not accurate. They weren't on the court enough to say that. Seth Towns only played two seasons. Bryce Aiken missed long stretches even when he was around. So, Christian Juzang, of course, this getting injured probably wouldn't have much. Very possible he wouldn't have played in the tournament. They would have had to do it without him with a backcourt that was not what it was meant to be. It's tough for Harvard, but they'll reload, and I'm sure they'll be in the top half of the league again. If they can't get there with blue chip talent, maybe they can get there the other way. They'll continue to get blue chip talent coming in, though. That's not going to stop.
And then a question will be if they get the tournament at their home gym next year or the year after.
Yeah, I mean that's got to be rough especially if you're Princeton, though, and you've been kind of planning on it, and your senior class, you're kind of psyched that you get it to be at Jadwin in 2021, and then suddenly. The rotation gets pushed back. That could be, I think it is unfair to Harvard, though, to get skipped. Do they get tacked on to the end in 2026 or 7 or whatever year it is? Or do they get to stay at the front of the line?
I think that was another one of those things that the day it happened, everybody would be like, no, go to the back of the line. But I think it's the way things obviously played out, they certainly deserve either next year or, the year after, give Princeton its year and then afterwards, bring it back to Harvard.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, that's something that we should know in the next few months. That will be announced in due time. One of the standouts for me, from a site perspective, is the fact that we had an awful lot of contributors this year. Definitely grateful for that. New contributors, Erica Denhoff as a terrific photographer for us. Palestra Pete covering Penn women's basketball. Jack Clark covering the Harvard men, and of course Nathan Solomon, great job covering Cornell. Richard Kent covering Yale, and Toothless Tiger and the Ancient Quaker doing a great job as usual. And Josiah Cohen actually returned to help out a little bit at the beginning of the season with Columbia. Very grateful, of course, Rob, for all of your contributions throughout the year. You know, it's a lot of action to cover, so I'm grateful for all the help that you know, everybody who finds it a labor of love contributed this season for IHO.
Yeah, a lot of people, and it's amazing how much news comes out of a small conference, small 8-team mid-major conference.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, this, you know, far before things got really surreal, it was still still a very high traffic news year, news season. So, yeah, a lot of good stuff to cover. But yeah, thanks to all who listened, read what we had to say. This should be the last podcast of the season, given that the sports world has already shut down at this point. Not a lot of action. Obviously, none on the court to cover, but you know, we'll reconvene as needed if any other big news cycles come up, good or bad. But yeah, sooner than we thought, that was the Ivy League season for 2019-2020. Yeah, any closing thoughts, Rob?
You know, a couple of just quick things I would say. You know, I speak for all the writers thanking you, Mike. You know, it's a tremendous effort you put forth, you know, organizing everything, editing everything, coming up with ideas, helping out, being there for as a sounding board. You know, you're an island of calm in our little world here, and it's greatly appreciated by everybody, you know, the writers and the readers. And I'm sure the people in the league office appreciate it as well. It's really great. You're a treasure for the league. Absolutely. And I can only hope that this lull is a short one for all of us, and that you know, we all put our partisan issues aside for a little bit and try and find some common ground and get through this together. And hopefully we will have a much calmer 2021.
Yes, and the rest of 2020.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, you're too kind. Thank you for the kind words, Rob. I'm happy to do it. You make my job a lot easier, as does the rest of the staff. Yeah, no, absolutely. Good time to stay safe. Stay sane, stay grateful, and yeah, that's about it. Thank you so much, Rob, for coming
thank
on
you.
And helping make sense of all of this.
I feel a little better than I did before I started this show.
Good. Well, mission accomplished then. I hope
all right.
I hope you're not alone. I'm in the same boat. So yeah, hope that we've had a similar effect for at least one listener out there. That would make this show a success. So yeah, thanks for listening, and connect with you again soon. Take care.